Hi, I'm Katrina Daniel, and welcome to Primetime Crime, a podcast for people who want to know what goes on behind the scenes of the most notorious trending crime stories and what's going on in the minds of those involved in those stories. What are the detectives, the judges, the defense attorneys, and the prosecutors thinking? You'll hear it all on Primetime Crime, the podcast. Welcome back to Primetime Crime. I'm Katrina Daniel. And Jeffrey Epstein's old friend, madam, pimp, girlfriend, major domo, whatever her many titles in the media, has just been found guilty in federal court in New York of 5 of the 6 counts against her. She's facing at least 60 years in prison. The defense team, led by a woman named Bobby C. Sternheim, who before this case had a reputation, in the New York media at least, of being a formidable defense attorney. That didn't turn out to be the case here in Guillen's case. Sternheim used the tried and often backfiring defense of blaming the victims. Bad call. She also did nothing to lessen Guillen's public persona as a spoiled, entitled, arrogant rich girl picking on way less fortunate and much younger girls. The Maxwell defense team also issued this statement explaining why Guillen Maxwell didn't testify in her own behalf. Here's the statement issued by her attorney. Quote, "The government has not proven its case beyond a reasonable doubt, so there is no need for me to testify," unquote. Arrogant much? Guess what, Guillen? The jury did think the government proved its case, so another bad call by you and your defense team.
I want to commend the bravery of the girls, now grown women, who stepped out of the shadows and into the courtroom. Their courage and willingness to face their abuser made today's result and this case possible.
Joining me now are two of the top criminal defense attorneys in Florida, maybe the country, because they've certainly done cases all over the country.
Definitely the country,
said my husband, Michael Rosen, and Joe Rosenbaum in Miami. Let's go dissect Guillen Maxwell's case. As you know, the verdict just came in. She was found guilty on 5 out of 6 counts. The only count she was found not guilty of was enticement, which if you look at the case, and she was the one who recruited girls in shopping malls, at tennis clubs, at bath clubs. I'm surprised that she was found not guilty of enticement. But what's your take on the verdict? Joe, let's go with you first.
It's kind of how I expected it to go. It relied on the testimony of the 4 victims. It was a testimony case, physical evidence. There was not a lot of, there was some corroborating evidence by the employees of Epstein, but the thing that I think got the guilty verdict is that even though there were some inconsistencies in the victim's statements, prior statements with the trial testimony, they were able to testify about things that really existed. The 4 of them kind of intersected each other. And the Epstein, that was the elephant in the courtroom. And a lot of times people are judged by the company they keep. So with all the things about Epstein, and her being with Epstein and the girls corroborating the places, the description of the places, the people, that tied in with the pilot's testimony, the employee's testimony, you know, and the last witness that they called, who's the one that they used her, that was the only one where the real name was used.
Annie Farmer.
Her testimony was vivid. The other ones were, there were some issues with, but hers was so vivid that it supported all the other testimony of the other 3 witnesses. Now, one of the witnesses, though, they called her Kate. She was over the age of consent when it happened to her. So the judge instructed the jury, you couldn't consider that in the verdicts, but you can use it as a background. And that's what they did. So it all tied together nicely. The prosecution did a really nice job. And the defense did the job that they could do, which was showing inconsistencies of statements, motive, bias, and taking apart the witnesses. But they had 4 good testifying witnesses and one that really slammed the door. And that was the government's last witness, Annie Farmer.
It seems to me the defense tactic of blaming the victim is getting a huge backlash, and not only in this case, but in lots of other cases as well. Michael, talk to me about your take on this.
Well, to Joe's point, a defense nightmare is when different witnesses start corroborating each other in terms of intersecting of testimony, even though there was not, you know, two people at the same place at the same time. Anytime the government has a series of witnesses that tie together their case, makes it very difficult. And one of the jobs of a defense lawyer, if you can do it, is to try to show a time or place where the witnesses may have gotten together to talk about their testimony. And that didn't exist in this case. So to the strength of the government or the state, you know, that's really where their strong case came in. And aside from what Joe said about the defense cross-examining for character, one of the things I observed was they tried to build her character, calling people that knew her that this is not the kind of conduct she would. Yeah, I mean, look, the fact that she chose to go to trial in and of itself is interesting. To your question about, you know, victims, you're never going to win a case on like this, blaming a victim. So what do? They tried to extract her from Epstein's conduct. They tried to say that she didn't know what was going on. And yet the evidence was really overwhelming. So there's a time and place blame on victims. This wasn't one of them.
Let's talk about the defense strategy as a whole. They did not let Ghislaine Maxwell testify. And the official statement Ghislaine Maxwell made in court was, quote, "The government has not proven its case beyond a reasonable doubt, period. So there is no need for me to testify," unquote. What a stupid, arrogant statement to make. How could her defense attorney have let her get away with that? It just, you know, their whole gig is that she is a socialite. This is beneath her. Well, this arrogant statement just did nothing but make her look worse than she actually is. And it seems to me the jury saw right through it.
Well, then
I have trouble believing she said that in front of the jury.
She didn't. That's what I was going to say.
That's testimony. That's testimony.
That was the reason she gave for not testifying.
Was that from the lawyer's mouth or her mouth?
Joe, here's the deal. It was her, that's what I asked. It was her statement, but let me just do a little bit of legalizing here for a second. That decision to make is asked of every defendant in a trial by a judge outside the jury's presence.
Correct.
To be sure that on appeal or on after an appeal and they've lost, they don't come back and say, "I wanted to testify and my lawyer wouldn't let me." So a judge always asks the defendant, "Do you want to testify?" That statement, I am certain, although I was not a fly in the room, was written by her lawyer, absolutely written by her lawyer as a statement for the media. The government's failed to prove its case. You don't like it. I get it. But that's what it was. But it was, I'm certain, not done in front of a jury.
Okay, I will leave that up in the air until I research it further. Nonetheless, it's just a really arrogant thing to say.
Yeah, but so, if it wasn't read in front of the jury, I don't have a problem.
Doesn't matter. They put on a really crappy defense. Bobby Sternheim took a risk thinking that, the government doesn't have enough evidence when in fact they did. Well, and let's compare this to the Kim Potter case.
Well, wait, hold on before you get there. Don't forget, putting Maxwell on the stand would have been worse. Why? Yes. Two of the counts were perjury for lying in depositions in the civil case years before. So they had evidence to prove that she lied, and now she's testifying again. I mean, her credibility is gone. You're charged with perjury on two different occasions, two different dates, the basic simple things. Putting that person on the stand in her trial gets even riskier. So I think those two counts kept her off the stand. And I don't disagree with keeping her off the stand because I don't think she could add nothing to the defense other than saying, "I didn't do it. I wasn't there. I wasn't part of it." And she did that by her not guilty.
Yeah, and also, as I know Joe knows, the value of not putting your client on the stand, and we can use this to slide into your next case, the value of a defendant not being called, which if you were ever to do an analysis, I don't know, Joe, 90% of the cases, 80% at most, defendants never testify. And the reason is, as a lawyer, defense lawyer, you can say to the jury from the outset, "I don't have to do a thing. I don't want to be here, but I have to be here. So you look to the government and make them do this and make them do that. And they've got to do, the moment you put your client on the stand, no matter what you try to do, it all shifts. So for her, like Joe said, she's already been either charged or convicted or determined to have been committed perjury. She could do nothing but take away whatever burden of proof the defense lawyer was trying to put onto to the prosecution. So it was an absolute no-brainer. She couldn't testify.
No, I know, because her character is just so in question. But as we slide into Kim Potter, the white police officer who shot and mistook her gun for her taser.
There she has to take the stand. She has to explain.
She did take the stand.
Yeah, she did. But she in that case, taking the stand, I think she had to. I know she did. But in order to explain what she was seeing, what she was doing, and the reasons behind what happened there, and the mistake, and whatever she, however her explanation was. Because without that, here you have an officer on a traffic stop where the person's trying to get away, pulling a gun and just killing him. So you needed her to testify.
Exactly. But there's also a huge difference in the two cases. Ghislaine Maxwell was involved with Jeffrey Epstein as his pimp, arguably, for 25 years. Kim Potter had one horrific mistake, accident. That's it. And she took responsibility for it immediately. Ghislaine Maxwell saying, oh, gee, my prison conditions aren't convenient for me and they shine lights at me. Well, come on, get a grip. They're doing that because Jeffrey allegedly hung himself. They're trying to keep you from doing so.
One of the things I thought was interesting is when you put a client on the stand and when you don't. And here you have a case where one person didn't, another person did, and both got convicted. So, I mean, on a certain level, it goes to establish, at least for discussion's sake, that it may not matter whether you put a defendant on. But Joe's right. Kim Potter had to explain, and you're right, the one single moment when this happened. Because otherwise, you've got her yelling taser and you've got her shooting the guy. So in this case, the lawyer's responsibility is to say to a jury, look, my client testified, but that doesn't change your responsibility to hold the government accountable and prove their case. If what she said raised any doubt in your mind about their case, you got to walk her. You got to acquit her.
Right. You need to explain to the jury that even though the defense put on a case, just put on the defendant, they don't have the burden of proof. They don't have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. The defense witnesses or the defendant is there for you to evaluate more evidence to see if the government is able to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. It does not shift the burden, period. And that's how you explain it to them. You start doing that in jury selection. If you know ahead of time you're going to put your client on the stand, you better start banging that during jury selection to see the reaction of the jurors. Because if you're trying to convince an audience that's not listening to you, you're not going to do very well, even if your show is very good.
And that, Joe, assumes that the judge is going to let you ask the jury any questions at all.
Yeah, but Kim Potter's a state case. State court judges usually allow you to ask more stuff.
Correct.
Federal judges, some of them don't allow you to ask anything.
Speaking of juries, just for a moment, kudos to the Ghislaine Maxwell jury, because they debated for a total of 40 hours. They were able to take time off for Christmas. They came back with a verdict. And let's talk about the defense in that case again. I think they did a really poor job of showing any of Ghislaine Maxwell's character in building any sympathy for her whatsoever. Her only defense would be, gee, I hung around with Jeffrey for 25 years, but I was too stupid and I never noticed anything.
Well, they called 10 witnesses, the defense.
Yeah.
Okay, they called 10 witnesses. And in an effort to both extract her from being involved with this guy, but also to present to the jury, look, every case, we lawyers are stuck with the facts. You just are. And you got to work with the facts that are there in front of you. And while you can try to massage them or raise questions about the evidence, the bottom line is there are certain cases, like I said in the beginning, her decision to go to trial, she had to know that the odds were tremendously bad against her. And yet she took that shot. And look, my experience, Joe's experience is you never know. You go to trial, you never know what's going to happen, even when the government's got what appears to be a good case. And so she took that shot. Now, the result is she's lost her ability to say to a judge, you know, I've owned up for my conduct. The judge is going to bang her anyway. So why not take your shot at trial? I did hear rumblings. Yeah, I guess I would call it journalistic rumblings.
Hey.
Of her now being in a position where she could cooperate. And that is something that the government, the state's now got a hammer over her head, where if you want to bring your troubles down and get, you know, 10 years instead of 50 or whatever, start talking. And that's now the conversation that's going to happen is who could she nail and who's next in line?
I'm thinking Prince Andrew is dripping sweat at about this moment.
Well, it all depends what the charges are. If it's going to be a federal charge, the statute of limitations might still be alive. But to be a federal charge, there has to be interstate commerce. There has to be crossing state lines for these sex cases. It can't just be in one state. So if it's just in one state, then you got to look to the state courts to see what the statute of limitations are for these types of crimes. And the statute is run on many of the state charges. So the prosecutor is going to have to pick through it to see if there's any viable prosecution left on the federal charges where the statute hasn't run.
I did hear this morning that she's facing another perjury trial, another perjury charge. They probably will bag that because they've gotten her on the larger charges. Would that be accurate?
It may be. It depends on what the perjury is. And it all depends on circumstances.
You know, Joe, a lot of times there will be multiple prosecutions because just in case something goes south on appeal, they've got another conviction.
Right.
Because they're
going to file the notice of appeal.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether she cooperates or not, just to preserve it, they'll file that within 14 days from the date of that the judgment is signed.
Yeah. Bobby Sternheim has already made her statement to the media saying, we're going to file an appeal immediately. Good luck with that, Bobby.
They could file it.
File your little heart out. Gee, Katrina, how do you really feel? So, Joe, you got any final opinions on this? What we can take home?
We can take home from it is that the former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Florida looks like a bigger ass than he really is.
That would be Alex Acosta?
That would be him. Cabinet member of the Trump administration. He was a labor secretary. He's the one that gave Epstein the deal of a lifetime.
Correct. In a hotel in Miami where he met with them privately. I remember
That's real what this thing underlines, that this government had a strong case and that for reasons that I don't know, we can all speculate, Acosta gave the case away. And that's where an investigation should be looked at.
Why wasn't there some accounting? Why has he gotten a pass on every review of this instead of calling him out and you know, even taking him to the bar, if not charging him with any sort of wrongdoing?
Well, there were hearings and motions to vacate the plea and allow the Southern District to prosecute, but that didn't happen. I'm not sure. I didn't follow it that closely.
Let me tell you what happened. The judge found that Acosta's conduct was not enough to set aside the deal that was
that he gave.
Made. Yeah.
Based upon his verdict and now the evidence that judge has heard, maybe the judge realizes that she made a mistake. But Acosta should be held accountable. There have been people that worked in that office, that worked on the case, that have come out and said that they were surprised by the decision, but something doesn't smell right and something was wrong in that. And maybe there should be a full investigation of it. And maybe Acosta has to be held accountable for what he did.
What are the odds of that?
I don't know. The Democratic administration, maybe there's some chance Republicans get back in. I don't think it'll ever happen. Because I think there was some, if you read the transcript of the pilot's testimony, who was on that plane.
Right, right.
I think that's an interesting factor that may be part of this. Don't know.
Okay, but if you're looking at the pilots and you were talking about interstate transport, he had the island, he had Palm Beach, and he had a ranch, and he had New York. So he being Jeffrey Epstein, he had homes in all those areas, and he took the young women to all those areas. So that's a federal case.
My takeaway is I look at this a little differently. I'm looking at two cases that went to trial, and I'm looking at it as a trial lawyer, where one case was almost impossible to win, if not impossible. And the other case was, maybe 50-50. And as a trial lawyer, every case, there's a discussion about a plea. Every case, there's a discussion about a resolution. And sometimes it's never enough. And you take your shot. Sometimes it is enough, and you have to swallow hard, and the defense guys say, I did it. And a lot of times that's just not able to be done.
Yeah. Or sometimes you have a client who did it, they can prove it, who just says, let them prove it. I'm not going to plead.
And I think that's the case. I think that was her situation. I think she said, you know what, whatever the odds are, I'm going to take my shot. And in the other case with Kim Potter, I think she had no choice. My takeaway is every case, people forget. Every case is so different. Joe and I have had clients that say, well, in that case, and you just have to look at them and say, that's not your case. And so analytically, I just found it interesting that one case that was pretty much impossible to win lost. To your point, jury put a lot of time and effort into it, and both juries did. In the other case, it was a toss-up and a very difficult case. One observation about the Potter case that I thought about later. The lawyer in that case had two issues that were in conflict. One, he had a client that made a mistake. But as the law says, under certain circumstances, second degree manslaughter, a mistake can be a crime. On the other hand, the right was apparently trying to get into his car and leave the scene where he was under arrest and he had outstanding weapons. If she had just shot him and was then faced with that issue of was it appropriate use of police force, how would that case have changed? Would she have ever been charged? And instead, she thought she shot him with her taser and didn't. And so you have these two conflicting issues. And the defense lawyer, Earl Gray, tried to use both of them. One was it was a mistake. One was the victim was trying to get away. And you got to be really careful how you do that. But as I analyzed it after the fact, I just thought that case as a trial lawyer was a very interesting case and a very difficult case.
Yes, it was, especially since my understanding is that the firearm is on the dominant hand side of the holster of the belt and the taser's on the non-dominant side. There's a difference in weight and a difference in color.
Right.
So
right.
To this day, I don't get it.
Neither do I. Anyway, gentlemen, thank you very much for your input. We'll reach out to you because I know there's going to be a lot more to talk about on this case.
So we've surely not seen the end of the not-so-lovely Ghislaine Maxwell. She's facing sentencing. She's also facing other charges like perjury. So it'll be interesting to see what happens next. Meanwhile, Happy New Year to all of you. On behalf of myself, producer Carmen Lucas, and engineer extraordinaire Wyatt Peake, let's hope for a much better 2022. And thanks for listening and following Primetime Crime. Thanks for listening to Primetime Crime, the podcast. Follow us on Facebook at Primetime Crime and on Instagram and Twitter at @PrimetimeCrime_. Post your comments and tell us what true crime stories you'd like to hear about. Subscribe to Primetime Crime on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Podcasts. Thanks a lot.